Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
Hey everyone, it's Jenna, and this week we are bringing you an interview that I recorded earlier this year with L.A. Kaufman, who is a longtime organizer and author of the book How to Read a Protest. The book traces the lineage of protest movements in the U.S., starting with the 1963 March on Washington. In this conversation, we dive into that history and talk about some of the things that go into making a successful protest. Like a lot of things in life, there is way more going on at these protests than what meets the eye. No Michael or Chris on this episode, but if you are looking for more from them on the role of protest in a democracy, I recommend checking out our episodes with civil rights leader Joyce Ladner and with Serge Popovic of Serbia's Otpor movement. You can find links to both of those episodes in the show notes. I learned a lot from this conversation with LA and from her book, and I think you will too. Two pieces of housekeeping before we get to the interview. We are starting production on our new season of Democracy Works, and we'll be back with new episodes in a few weeks. If there's anyone you think we should be talking to or a topic you think we should be covering, we would love to hear your suggestions. You can visit our website, democracyworkspodcast.com, and submit the form to contact us or leave us a voicemail. Either way, we'd love to hear from you. And finally, we are in the running for a 2019 People's Choice Podcast Award. We won one of these awards last year and would love to keep the momentum going this year. So if you have a chance, please head to podcastawards.com and nominate Democracy Works in the government and organizations category. The nomination period runs until July 31st. So that's it for the housekeeping. Thanks again for listening, and please enjoy my conversation with L.A. Kaufman. L.A. Kaufman, thanks for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book, How to Read a Protest, traces the history of protest movements, starting with the 1963 March on Washington. And protests are often thought of as a hallmark of democratic dissent, but in reading about the 63 March in your book, it seems that it wasn't organized in a very democratic way, nor were there many opportunities for dissent within the movement. So I'm wondering how that march came about and what made it the movement that subsequent protests have been compared to ever since.
Sure. That's a great question. Yeah. One of the things I always like to say as a framing comment before I dive in is that there are many, many different kinds of protests, and they don't all work the same way. And a lot of the work that I do in some ways is protest literacy. There are more Americans taking part in protests now than at any point in the past. So many millions have marched and rallied since Donald Trump took office that it dwarfs even the height of the Vietnam era. And yet people tend to lump them all together and not really understand that there's many different kinds of protests with many different functions within the broader context of social movements. So this book and the 63 March is about a particular kind of protest above all, which are mass mobilizations where huge numbers of people come together out in the streets. And the 63 March on Washington, whatever dim ideas you might have of protest in American past, it actually was the first one. Which surprised me although I'm a longtime organizer, I hadn't quite realized that before 1963, we never had anything on this scale, in American history. The 63 March ended up bringing 250,000 people. So that was a unique organizing challenge to bring that. I mean, there had been parades like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. There had been large public gatherings, but they hadn't been protests. And this was the first time it happened, and there was an enormous amount of fear surrounding the event. A lot of that fear, blatantly racist fear of large numbers of Black Americans converging in one place at one time, and the racist certainty that there would be violence and rioting if that happened. So as you were suggesting with your question, one of the ways that the organizers compensated for those fears was by kind of going on overdrive with an organizing model they already were operating from, a pretty top-down controlled organizing model that came out of the old left. And then they reacted to the fears of disorder and unruliness by controlling every aspect of the march in a way that is someone I was the mobilizing coordinator for some of the largest marches that have happened since, some of the marches in 2003 and 2004, and it's extraordinary what they did in 63. They you couldn't bring your own signs, you couldn't have your own slogans, and they actually had people who surrounded you and took away your messages if you did, as you say, we think of this as a high water point of American democracy. And yet the messages were so controlled, there was no room for individual voice there.
There were certainly no shortage of things that happened before 1963 that could have sparked something like this. What was it about that moment that was a tipping point? And why do you think we didn't see something on this larger scale happen sooner?
Well, this was a very, very daring thing to do. I mean, there had been suffrage parades. There was, during World War II, the kind of predecessor of the 63 March on Washington was a march that never happened, but that was threatened. It was a civil rights march that forced the threat of which forced FDR's hand and led him to desegregate the armed forces and ban discrimination by military, racial discrimination by military contractors, which was a major advance at the time. But the scale of protests before this were some, you know, typically more like the largest ones were more like 25,000 or 50,000 people. I think no one had dreamed before the event where Dr. King gave the I Have a Dream speech, of bringing together these huge numbers of people. And then we've seen, once this practice started, it was repeated again and again and again. I went back, one of the things I have in the book, or I have several charts about the largest protests in American history viewed through different criteria. Some are the largest protests in D.C., some are the largest single events. And one chart is about the largest days of protests all around the U.S. Once this model was established, it really caught on. And you saw movement after movement trying to replicate the success of the March on Washington by bringing huge numbers of people. It's sort of like once that that barrier to seeing this tactic as manageable and not a fearsome thing was broken, it became a model that everyone wanted to emulate.
There was also a great deal of compromise necessary to make the 63 March happen. Can you talk about some of those compromises and how the various groups organizing the march worked together?
Well, the very first idea of the 63 March on Washington was it was going to not just be a march, but it was also going to be an occasion for nonviolent civil disobedience. And it was going to represent a real tactical escalation. And those plans got dropped almost immediately as soon as the organizers began negotiating with the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration was sort of walking a very complicated line because they very clearly did not want the march to happen. And then once the march was clearly going to happen, whether they agreed to it or not, they did everything they could to control it. And part of that was by orchestrating the choreography of it so that it didn't actually, they changed the march route so that the march never went past the White House or the Capitol. There are no pictures from the 63 March where you see crowds of marchers and a building that represents one of the targets of the protests in the background. It was staged, so it was kind of against the backdrop of these grand symbols of American democracy, like it's the, like the culmination of the pledge of democracy, as opposed to a protest against inaction by the president and Congress, either of whom could have been taking much more substantial action than they were at that moment on civil rights.
You know, I can't help but think of what's happened more recently with the women's marches and some of the differences that have emerged between the groups involved with organizing those events. Do you think that we're in a better place now where groups that do have different perspectives can express their opinions as opposed to everyone trying to speak with one voice, as was the case in the 60s?
There was more disunity behind the scenes in the 63 March than the mythology would lead you to believe. I mean, there wasn't there weren't open divisions and splits among the players, but there were definitely very substantial differences of opinion about strategy and direction for the movement, and a lot of internal tension. Sometimes those things stay behind the scenes, and sometimes they split out in the open. But I think that the model of a single unified coalition that that we think of and associate with the 63 March, there are moments when we return to that model over and over again. But a lot of the way in which movements have unfolded in the decades since has been much more of a networked model, more decentralized, where people come together or converge at different moments, but there's not the same emphasis on unity, in the singular sense. We have a movement of many movements as opposed to the idea that we all need to be under one single tent. And so when I look at what happened, with the women's marches, the most recent round, the third iteration of the women's marches, my takeaway after, all the coverage that was expended on the controversies around the national leadership and the handful of breakaway local marches, my takeaway really is the resilience of the grassroots and the resilience of there were more than 300 local events around the country, which I think is quite extraordinary 3 years on, and shows how much a movement that has many leaders and many organizing centers can persist in ways that maybe are hard for the national media to see and perceive, but that have very powerful effects when it comes to things like organizing get out the vote operations in the midterm elections.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You also spend a lot of time in your book talking about the signs that people bring to protests. What can we learn about a protest from those signs that people bring?
Yeah, well, the moment that first got me working on this book was when I attended the 2017 Women's March in D.C., and it was this incredible outpouring that so outstripped the organizing resources on the ground that it wasn't a march really at all. It was just a flood of women and allies everywhere. And having been to, I can't even count how many protests I've been to in my 35 years as an organizer and journalist, and I was immediately struck that there was a far higher percentage of homemade signs at the women's marches than I had ever seen before. And so, and then I discovered the detail that I alluded to earlier about the 63 march, that whatever we may think of it, and whatever, however many ways it may represent a high point of American democracy, in this one interesting respect, in the messaging, it was a moment of total control because all of the signs were produced by the organizers and you could not bring your own slogan to that march. You could make your own sign with one of their pre-approved slogans, but they didn't really encourage it. They really wanted that uniform look and feel. And so I explore a lot in this book the relationship between what a protest looks like and how it came together. And the ways in which these pre-printed signs, sometimes what they do is they reveal to you, an organization that has a close relationship to its members. And so its members feel close identification and want to carry those signs to show, they belong to the ACLU or the NAACP or whoever it is. And sometimes it just means they have a printing budget and money to hand out a bunch of signs to people who don't really have any connection to them, right? It can be very difficult to tell just looking at it. I think of it as it's like a sign that gets you to ask questions. But with those handmade signs at the 2017 Women's Marches, what I really saw happening, there wasn't ever a memo that went out that told women to do that, just as there wasn't a memo that went out that told people to organize in their communities all over the country. It was a thing that really spread virally. And there was a way in which after the shock of the election and the fear and the depression that so many of those who would go on to march in women's marches were feeling, it was a very literal reclaiming of voice to make your own sign with your own view on this calamitous moment in American history on it. And there was such a power in that. And there was such a way in which what people did at those first round of marches, they weren't putting pressure on the Trump administration per se. They were finding each other. It was a moment for people to come together in the streets and feel a sense of community, engage in a political conversation. All those signs amounted to like a rich political conversation in the streets, and feel a sense of collective power which in turn made possible the resistance organizing we've seen since.
Yeah, and the signs also serve as a way for the protests to live on through social media and other channels. But it also, I think, calls into question how genuine people's motivations are in attending a protest. A cynic might say that people are only showing up so they have a photo to post on Instagram and show their friends that they were there. Do you have a sense of what people's motivations are based on your experience as an organizer?
To whatever extent we're living in a time where you get like social and cultural points for showing yourself at a protest, I mean, that's great. But I don't know that people go because they're going to get Facebook likes, you know, from posting a picture of themselves. I think people do sometimes go to protests with unrealistic ideas of what they'll accomplish by going. And that are fed by kind of mass media myths about protest, that tend to frame protests as short-term pressure tactics, when that's often not how they work. So I think sometimes what happens is people come to a protest and they, you know, have some idea, they're drawn because they want to take action. But then they have an expectation that just turning out once in large numbers is going to bring change. And, you know, those of us who've been in the trenches for a long time know that, you know, any protest, however large, is usually just one step in an unfolding process of change. And you rarely see decision makers shift or change based on one event. It's usually a very long and protracted process to create change. And oftentimes what these larger mobilizations do more than anything else is sustain movement morale and momentum. So they are less pressure tactics than they are movement building tactics. You know, so from that sense, if people, you know, go and they feel good enough about being there that's part of how they're going to present themselves to the world on their social media feeds as a person who participates in a protest, I don't see that as a hollow or meaningless gesture. The question that I always ask about any of these forms of political action is, what do they build to? So, you know, do the people who went to the march and posted their picture on social media, are they then more likely to pick up the phone and make a phone call to their member of Congress? Those are the questions that always really interest me, is the extent, because I think these mass gatherings, because their significance is in an unfolding process, part of, to me, how I gauge their effectiveness is how much likelier were people to go on and take additional action afterwards than they might have been if they hadn't gone.
The other thing that we hear about protests a lot is that they don't really mean anything, which you argue is a narrative pushed by those in power who want to discredit the protesters and maintain the status quo. What does that effort look like, and how can people who want to be involved in protests push back against it?
Absolutely. There's a dominant discourse that tells us that protest doesn't work, which, you know, very effectively discourages people from participating in protests because they feel it's pointless. The 63 March plays a very interesting role in this discourse. There's a wonderful book that came out last year called A More Beautiful and Terrible History by the political scientist Jean Theo Harris, that looks at, the subtitle is, I believe, the uses and abuses of civil rights history. And she looks at how, you know, various iconic events and figures of the civil rights movement, including the 63 March, have been used in this insidious way to kind of chastise and demoralize subsequent movements. There's a way in which that 63 March, without wanting to take away from its true importance, we can say it's been enshrined in myth to such a degree that there's pretty much no real world event that could ever feel as hallowed and as sanctified as that event has been. So there's a way in which it gets held up as this shining example that makes everything else feel small and inconsequential in comparison. People are always really surprised when I tell them that there's more people taking part in protests now than there were in the height of the Vietnam era. Because there again, we have this myth, we have these ideas about these events that have been made larger than life. You know, the protests at the 68 Democratic Convention, the number of protesters was in a few thousands. It was very small compared to many things that had happened before or since. But in the glare of the TV cameras and in the way it's been, you know, retold in history, it becomes magnified. And that magnification makes us not quite able to see the actual scale of contemporary efforts the way that we otherwise might.
We talk a lot on this show about the hard work of democracy, and organizing seems to be squarely within that realm. What goes into organizing a large protest, and how do the people involved deal with burnout?
Right. I mean, people do it out of a sense of hope, out of a sense that it can make a difference. I always use Rebecca Solnit's distinction between optimism and hope, where optimism is the sort of starry-eyed view that everything's going to be okay, as opposed to hope, which is the idea that by taking action, we can make things better than they otherwise would be. So, you know, there's a sense of hope that gets engaged. But, you know, those of us who've been doing this for a very long time have that sense of hope tempered by realism and by the understanding that, you know, victories are hard to come by. It takes a long time. You're going to lose many times before you win. Sometimes you don't make any progress at all, or you don't see the progress that you're making for years and years. You know, I think about the folks who fought so hard during the height of the AIDS epidemic. And didn't know what we know now, that their actions would end up saving millions of lives, you know, what it was like to keep fighting, despite that. So, you know, the movements themselves, always, come in cycles. They have periods of growth and decline. And, it's very easy for people to get burned out, if they don't have that longer view. That makes them, you know, first of all, not overdo in the short term, pace themselves in terms of their level of involvement, but also recognize, you know, that, you know, as King put it, the arc of history is long. You know, it takes a very long time, with many reversals and setbacks to make change. And you have to, believe in your heart that taking action is the only hope to make it real. You know, that's what has to sustain you over the long term, because it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be riches, rewards, you know, material gain, and it's not going to be an immediate sense of progress in most cases.
And finally, where do things go from here? Are there things that today's organizers can maybe learn from the past?
Well, I think that the thousands of resistance groups that came out of, you know, that early period of the Trump presidency, most of which are affiliated with Indivisible, not all of them, you know, will continue doing work. The impact of that work on the midterms was extraordinary. And what the open question now is, how are we writ large, sort of the opposition or resistance writ large, going to build upon the new footholds that we have with this new Congress in order to galvanize more grassroots response? You know, we saw, I think, a solid turnout for the women's marches. The energy levels were not as high as they were 2 years ago. You wouldn't expect them to be. But the real question for me is whether we're going to see a new upsurge as we build on these new openings.
We will leave it there. L.A. Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy Works.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.